Greetings. If you're listening to this, you're likely already aware that in response to a growing number of recommendations related to coronavirus, COVID-19, we've canceled our services here at St. Catherine's United Mennonite for the next few weeks. Given that you're listening through our website, you'll have seen that we have a link to a statement providing a bit more context to that decision. We'll update and keep you posted as things continue to develop. But in the meantime, be taking precautions and be well. Because our service is canceled, I'm going to do something I've never done before and that, frankly, I'm not all too comfortable with. And that's recording the message I had prepared for Sunday. Much as this is a time filled with a lot of uncertainty and upheaval, it's also an incredible time in a way when we're able to connect in these digital ways and still, still receive in that way. We were planning for Sunday to continue our sermon series on the book of Daniel, which we've called Integrity. And we're looking, as you might be aware, at what the story and life of Daniel might show for us, show us about faithful living in our world, our context today. And I'll start, I suppose, by reading the text I had chosen. It comes to us from Daniel 3, verses 8 to 15. If you have time at home, I'd encourage you to read through the whole chapter, but I'll just read through that for you now. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hands?" Some of you listening, assuming part of our community here, might know that I come from a family of first responders. My father's the chief of his local fire departments, and my sister's a firefighter with another station a little further away. Often when I'm visiting them, we'll talk about their latest call-outs. Excuse me, they'll share about some of the accidents, the medical calls, the rescues, and of course the fires that they've responded to in the past while. We'll also sometimes talk about stories of fires that have come up in the headlines. I'm often curious to get their perspective. So some time ago, I mentioned seeing a headline about two firefighters in Toronto who were injured after falling from what was either the ladder or the burning building itself. My father, it turns out, had heard about it and was, of course, sympathetic, but also shook his head a little. He told me about a little saying that he's come to take as a kind of guide for firefighting, a little saying that he's told me he's shared with his department a number of times. It goes like this: risk a lot to save a lot, risk a little to save a little, risk nothing to save nothing. In this particular situation, he told me there really was no reason to be taking that sort of risk. The building was abandoned, no one was in there, there weren't even any material valuables. My father told me that in years gone by, the firefighters and other service professionals might have thrown themselves into dangerous situations like this, and that it resulted for years in high numbers of injuries and casualties. And so these days, they'll still do everything they can to save what they can of the property, but at the end of the day, if it's just property, they're not going to put their lives on the line for it. There's insurance. Things can be rebuilt, let alone if it's an empty, abandoned building as it was in this situation. Risk a lot to save a lot, risk a little to save a little, risk nothing to save nothing. As I've mentioned, we're continuing our series on the life of Daniel, a series focusing on this theme of integrity. And for this morning, we're focusing on chapter 3, which is likely a familiar story to many of you, the story of the fiery furnace. You might have noticed as you heard it read by me, and perhaps as you read along, that Daniel himself doesn't actually appear in this story. It's notably absent. Why that is remains a bit of a mystery. All the same, I believe we can find in this ancient story guides and examples for living in our time today. Risk a lot for the sake of a lot, risk a little for the sake of a little, and risk nothing for the sake of nothing. I wonder if there's truth and wisdom in that statement. Certainly for firefighters and other first responders who regularly assess risk, people whose work it is to go into dangerous situations, but maybe there's also a kind of wisdom in that statement for people of faith, for people of spiritual conviction who desire to live faithfully and obediently in a world full of uncertainty and occasionally danger. As we look at this text together, I would invite you to look for the ways that the people it describes might be following that sort of wisdom, the ways that they can be seen to be willing to risk a lot for the sake of lots when it comes to what they believe and how they desire to live. Again, risk a lot for the sake of a lot, risk a little for the sake of a little, and risk nothing for the sake of nothing. Last time I spoke on this theme, we looked at Daniel chapter 1, which detailed Daniel's training in Babylon, along with his companions there. This time we're skipping past chapter 2, which recounts a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. You maybe remember the story. He had this dream that he had left, that had left him deeply troubled and searching for someone who could make sense of its meaning. And through this series of events and prayer and divine intervention, Daniel said to be able to provide an interpretation of all the things that the king had seen as he slept. And because of this, Nebuchadnezzar is all the more pleased with Daniel. He places him in a position of power. From then on out, we read that Daniel is made ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed in charge of all its wise men, which brings us to chapter 3, where I'm focusing my time and our time today. Here we're told that Nebuchadnezzar goes on to construct this massive statue. He gathers all his leaders around and tells everyone how it's going to be. When you hear the music playing, you'll bow and you'll worship it. And that's not a suggestion if you understand what I'm saying. Not clear enough for you. If anyone doesn't, they'll be thrown into the incinerator. As I shared last time, we were in this book, this is a tactic of empires, a strategy of conquering leaders and of tyrants. Demand uniformity, order that everyone be assimilated, make it law that everyone behaves accordingly or else. Which seems to work for Nebuchadnezzar for a little while, until, that is, we hear that not everyone is bending to it. The king receives a report that there are dissenters, non-compliant Jews, and that they were men that he had promoted and put in charge of the region, no less. It was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, David's companions. And they neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up, he's told. Nebuchadnezzar's livid, he's furious. Have them brought here, he barks at the whistleblowers, and so the three of them are seized and dragged into the king's court. Is this true? Nebuchadnezzar asks, as if he really cared whether they or not they admitted it was. And like you'd see in the movies, maybe he offers them one last chance. You'll hear the music again soon, he tells them, and if you have any wits about you and want to save your skins, you'll bow and worship along with everyone else. I'm giving you one last chance to change your mind, he tells them. It's all you need to do to avoid the flames. It's not that hard. You'd be idiots not to. Just kneel when everyone else kneels. If you don't, well, you know what will happen if you don't. And then who's going to help you? Which God could ever spare you from that? That saying that I shared at the start, risk a lot for the sake of a lot, risk a little for the sake of a little, risk nothing for the sake of nothing, is commonly shared amongst firefighting professionals. From what I've read, it has been for some time. And from what I've read, most agree that it's a good piece of advice to go by. The challenge they talk about, however, is that you're making that call in real time. Because fires can develop and progress rapidly, often in just a matter of minutes, those who've been called out don't have a lot of time to make a decision. And yet, assessment is critical. Stopping, however briefly, before proceeding with any kind of action is absolutely necessary. This kind of risk assessment is very much on our mind these days, in our worlds, in our churches, as we make decisions on how to proceed. In some firefighting circles, this is apparently called a size up, or sometimes a 360-degree size up. It's when you take in all the information that you have, you look at the situation for what it is and from as many angles as you can, and then you make your decision. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are faced with a situation. We don't know how long they were there or how much time they were allowed to deliberate. From the sounds of it, this Babylonian ruler wasn't the most patient or understanding type, and so it was likely that they only had a matter of minutes to do it. Maybe not even that. I wonder, though, if they paused just for the shortest of moments to consider the cost, to assess the situation, to think about what would be risked and what was at stake. I don't know. What we do know is that they didn't know what it might cost for certain. In the same way that no person, not even the most well-trained and well-informed person, understands all the possible risks. Again, this is on our minds, very much in our world, our communities today. The language of verse 17, if you look at it, is complicated to interpret. If you're following along in a Bible, you'll likely see it paired with a footnote. Some translations make it read something like this: If God is able to deliver us, then let God deliver us. Others say something like, if we are thrown into the furnace, God is able to deliver us. In any case, it's this sense of certainty mixed with uncertainty. It reflects a sense of certainty about God's character, about what the God of Israel is capable of, and very well might do if it came to that. But it's also a sense of uncertainty as to whether or not, if it came to that, God would in fact do that. Whether or not, if it came to that, God truly would deliver them. So it's an open question. And so the three of them have to make a call in real time, knowing what they know and believing what they believe. They make their decision and inform Nebuchadnezzar of it. They determine that what's at stake merits the risk. What's at stake in the situation is worth the potential cost it might mean for them. Even if God does not deliver us, they tell him, we want you to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. And so they set their fates and they face the flames. And unless you understand, like they understood, what was at stake, their decision will seem like pure folly. Just this unnecessary and mortally reckless risk. Because you can just cross your fingers and worship with everyone else, we might tell them. God knows what's in your heart and that you don't really mean it. It doesn't really matter if this is what you're doing in public. Who cares if they see you doing it? You can come home and still be a good Jew, we might tell them. You can ask forgiveness later. It's better to be alive and still serve God in some way than to be dead and not. Unless we see what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saw, unless you understand what they understood, none of it will make any sense. In the same way that unless you see what the firefighter sees when they look at a burning building, you're not going to understand why they would choose to risk their own lives and well-being to enter in. Daniel's companions saw what was at stake. They were willing to risk a lot for the sake of a lot, because as they pictured the flames, they saw something precious within, something valuable, something perhaps even irreplaceable. They saw life. At stake were their spiritual convictions, their obedience, their sense of integrity. And for them, for each of them, that was enough, more than enough for them to say yes to the risk. If you looked it up, you'd learn that the word's integrity comes from this much older Latin word that means soundness, wholeness, or completeness. It's as opposed to a divided existence, what the book of Proverbs calls duplicity. It reflects a kind of consistency. It means that who you are out in the world is consistent with who you are with your faith community or at home. It means that your external behaviors or actions are consistent with what you hold to be your internal spiritual commitments. And we know that because of our human condition and human rebellion, none of our hearts and none of our lives are ever perfectly aligned. But nonetheless, as people of faith, we're called to and invited to live lives of integrity. Lives like those of Daniel and his friends that are marked by a kind of soundness and wholeness and completeness, which maybe ought to leave some of us with some uncomfortable questions and might lead to some difficult soul-searching and reflection. Because while we may never find ourselves in a situation like theirs, there are likely times when we've heard the voices that the three of them very well might have heard. Voices like, just cross your fingers and go along with everyone else. God knows what's in your heart and that you don't really mean it. It's not that big a deal. It really doesn't matter what you do in public. You can come home and still be a good Christian. You can ask forgiveness later. And of course, there is forgiveness. As I said, when we looked at this book last time, we can begin again, begin anew. And that truly is good news. But the other good news is that this story shows us in a really powerful way, I believe, is that a spiritually undivided life is possible, even when there are enormous forces in your life threatening to pull you in other directions. It shows us that a life of spiritual integrity is possible, that with God's help and with God's presence, we can be creatively obedient, even in circumstances where there's enormous pressure to abandon or betray your convictions and to conform to the dominant pattern, to the way of the empire. Those three Jewish men were able to say yes to the risk, no matter what it would mean, go on to mean for them. We will not serve your gods, they said, or worship the image of gold that you have set up. We read in this chapter that King Nebuchadnezzar lost it when he heard them say this. He was so overcome with anger that the author tells us his face became distorted. The man who had given them one last chance quickly disappears in this wild fit of rage and is transformed into a kind of monster. Burning inside with fury, Nebuchadnezzar orders that the furnace be heated up 7 times hotter than it typically runs. He calls the mightiest men of his army to come and bind the three of them up and then throw them into the flames. And it's so hot, we're told, that when they do this, all the soldiers immediately keel over and die from the heat. And just as we readers think that this must certainly be the end for these young men, because who could survive such a thing? The king cries out, weren't there 3 men that were tied up and thrown into the fire? His advisors are confused. Yes, there were three. There were three of them. We saw all of them. There are three. Then why do I see four people? He blasts out at them. There are four, can't you see? And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar rushes over to the furnace and yells at them to come out. And they do, just like that. Their bindings have disappeared, but their clothes are intact and their hair is unsinged. And in this wonderful and profoundly ironic reversal, the king of Babylon, who issued the commands, punishable by death, that all bow down and worship the thing that he had constructed, now begins praising their gods, the God of Israel. And even more, he issues another decree in that moment, that if anyone says anything about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they will meet the same fates that those men were originally condemned to. Now, as I said last time, the point here is not that if we do the right thing faith-wise, we'll be guaranteed safe passage like these men were. I was reading a news story a while back of this terrible situation during a recent season of California's wildfires. It happened in the city of Paradise, which you might remember hearing about. The fire there had shifted quickly and was about to engulf one of the local hospitals. And the hospital chaplain gathered as many patients as he could fit into his minivan and began driving as fast as he could to get out of there. And in this news story, he recalls praying and telling the patients about the story of the fiery furnace, this story from Daniel. And he said, "We just need God's hand to cover us, to cover this vehicle, and the fires can be all around us, but they won't touch us." And in this news story, they talk about how they did all manage to make it out safely and survive this potentially deadly situation. And we might look at that story and say that indeed is a bold example, an example of bold faith and answered prayer. And that might or might not all be true, but that's not the point of the story of the fiery furnace as we find it here in Daniel. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were confident and courageous in their trust that God was able to see them through unscathed, but their safety was never a given. "Even if God doesn't," they said, "this is our decision." Nor, of course, is it a given for us, as tempting as that might be for us to use or read or teach the book of Daniel in that way. The point is not that if you do the right thing, God will protect you from all suffering and you'll get a promotion like they do here. The author is trying to make a much bigger point about who God is. The author is pointing to a powerful recognition of God's supremacy from someone who's perhaps one of the last and least likely people to recognize it in this story. The point is that in a world where any number of powers might pressure us to direct our worship and our service towards any number of things that are not God, we choose to bend our lives to God alone. The point is that even in a context like this, a context that is openly hostile, an empire that demands absolute allegiance and will not tolerate dissent on the basis of spiritual conscience, even in a context like that, the call to live faithfully and with integrity rings out. There's a possibility of creative obedience. There's a way of doing that, of being a people of inventive integrity, of risk-taking faithfulness. There's a way of living and leading an undivided life. Risk a lot for the sake of lots. Risk a little for the sake of a little, risk nothing for the sake of nothing. There's a challenge in that statement, and there's a wisdom in it as well, I believe. I'll say, though, that the wisdom of that statement might work in the opposite way as well. In this story, we see an example of risking a lot for the sake of a lot. It's a powerful example. But there are also plenty of times in our lives where we really ought to not take the risk. Times when what's at stake really isn't worth sticking our necks out that far for. Again, this is on our minds this week as we think about risks and what's worth the risk and what's not worth the risk at this time. And I sometimes see this with people in other ways too, and I shake my head and want to tell them it's really not worth it. You don't need to throw yourself on the flames battling this thing. Spiritually thinking, there are a lot of molehills that really just are molehills and not mountains that we should feel obliged to die on. Not everything is a matter of life and death. We don't always need to react brashly and get burns in the process. There are times, a lot of times, when we might feel like a crisis to us, and we might want to rush in and do something. But when you stop and look, you'll see that the building is actually abandoned, and no one is inside, and nothing is at risk, and that it's responsible enough just to watch and make sure the fire doesn't spread. It involves making a call. Risk a lot for the sake of a lot. Risk a little for the sake of a little. Risk nothing for the sake of nothing. It can be difficult, maybe, to think of what this might mean or not mean or look like for us today, for me today. In the same way that most of us would say that we'd probably never be in a situation as dramatic or critical as those firefighters sometimes might face, we'd probably say that most of us would never face a situation as dramatic or critical as the one that Daniel's three friends faced here. Some of us might, I don't know, many throughout history have, and many around the world still do today. More often, though, I wonder if it's more likely to be that we find that our commitments and integrity is tested in smaller ways. Seldom is it that the pressure comes to us from the ruler of the nation, a tyrannical dictator, as it does in this story, and yet pressure does come to us from all sorts of different places. And in my experience, it does often come so suddenly, so quickly, that you have just minutes or seconds to assess it all and come up with a response, which can be frightening thing to think about, really frightening. Will I make the right decision? Will I make the right call? For firefighters, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and for us, it has something to do with who we are and how we act in that moment itself, but I suspect that it has as much, if not more, to do with the kinds of training we do. I suspect that a life of learning and habits and repeated practice allows you to respond with a kind of prepared instinct or intuitiveness in those moments that come so suddenly. And imagine that my father, the fire chief, would tell you that it's the firefighters that miss practices or are behind on their training or skip out on the majority of calls that he would most worry about when it comes to making a quick judgment call while on the scene of a crisis. Again, those moments of severe testing and response don't come often, but they might, and throughout the course of our lives, smaller moments frequently do. In any case, I believe that being formed in that way through learning and repetition and meeting together and through practice might allow you to look at a situation with greater clarity and courage and to be able to make that call. And that if in the midst of it all you see what is valuable and precious, you'll be able to take the risk, if it comes to it, to risk a lot for the sake of a lot. Amen.